Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome back to the History of Video Games. My name is Wes, and I'm here, as always, with the wonderful Ben. How you doing today, Ben?
Doing great. How are you, Wes?
I'm doing pretty dang good. Liking, you know, we're getting to some warmer weather, at least for the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Hoping it sticks around. But, as always, still been playing games. You know how it goes. Well, let me think. Why don't you start us off? I think yours might be a little more interesting than what I've got to say, but we'll see. I'm curious what you got to talk to us about.
I've got a really weird one to talk about this week, Wes. It's a game that I got in my Humble Bundle and picked more or less at randomly. It's called Wander Song.
Okay, yeah.
But it's spelled W-A-N. Is that still Wander or Wander? I don't think it's Wander Song. That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, it's Wander. Like wandering around, yeah.
Okay. But anyway, it's Wander Song, and this one kind of confused me a bit. I ended up playing to completion because I looked up the time to beat, and it was 10 hours, and I was like, I can stomach this for 10 hours. But I didn't enjoy my time with it for the most part.
Oh, no.
I mean, there's parts about it that I like. It's obviously like a little indie game, and its main mechanic is that you sing. You're like a bard, and the whole story is like you're not the hero. You're just some guy who can sing and has passion, you know?
Nice.
But someone's got to save the world. Nobody wants to do it. So I guess it's you. And basically there's boss fights and enemies and puzzles and stuff. And you solve them all by singing. And it sounds kind of cool. I'll say from a music, you know, one musician to another, nothing about the music, you know, bothered me in that way. Like I thought all the music was great in the game, but the main, like, implementation of the music's kind of weird. It used a joystick, so I had to use my controller for this, and essentially there'd be like six different directions that you could press the joystick button, and they would be like six different notes that you would sing. So whichever way you're holding the joystick would be a different note.
Okay.
But a lot of the boss battles and stuff ended up being kind of like Simon Says mini games, where it would be like, you know, and instead of like note names, they would put it in colors. So it would be like purple, yellow, yellow. And then you would do the direction. So you would sing the purple note, then the yellow note, then the yellow note again. And that was like one of the main mechanics of the game. I'm like, Simon Says is not a fun game. I don't know. It tried to switch it up, right? It would have me jumping on things. There's a platforming element to make the note sometimes instead of singing. I think my favorite sections of the game involved the singing with the platforming. So there was a section where there were these like gusts of wind that would kind of come up from the bottom of the screen, and you could shape what direction the wind pushes you in by singing a certain direction using the joystick.
Cool.
So that was cool. There was another one. You were like on top of a plant, and the plant would kind of grow its stem up. If you press the singing up button, then you could kind of direct the plant left or right by singing some different pitches. That was cool. But the game is like, I don't want to say it's like made for kids, but there was nothing challenging about the game at all. It's definitely like a chill, have fun game. So the platforming wasn't hard at all. And just led to another section, which was Simon Says. So it wasn't the best. I did like the world that they made. It was very like kind of cutesy, wonderful world. You kind of hopped around to some different locations and met a bunch of different characters. And by the end, you kind of were reunited with them all again, which was cool. So I kind of liked a lot of the things. You had kind of a companion character, like this witch lady who was really cool. And I liked her story. So there's things I liked in it, but the core gameplay just wasn't that interesting. So I ended up kind of like zoning out a lot of it and just being like, get me to the end. And yeah, I probably wouldn't recommend it, but it has some interesting ideas. It tried something different. I think as a little indie game, it's fine, you know, and I'm sure it's going to have its people that really, really like it. I think it's actually, I think, overwhelmingly positive on Steam. So I guess if you know what you're getting into, you're going to like it. It's just like the gameplay just wasn't for me.
Yeah. Okay. Fair. Yeah, it sounds interesting, but yeah, a little simple. That's cool, though. I always like when games try to mix music and you know, gameplay together. It can be done well. It can be done not very well, but very cool.
Yeah, it had like kind of these rhythm sections where you would have to hit the notes at a certain time. But I felt like if I messed it up, which would be very rare because it's not hard. But if, I felt like if I messed it up, it would just wait for me to hit the right note and then it would continue.
So there was really no real like punishment or anything. Yeah.
So, yeah. A little too easy maybe. But that was Wonder Song. I mean, it was different. I'll say that. What about you, Wes? What have you been playing?
Well, I've still been deep in Witcher 3.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm almost at the point where I've caught up to where I was before, which is great because I think I put 60 hours into it before. I've put like 35 hours into it since picking it up again. And now I'm just kind of like I caught up to the main story to where I was before, but I'm just grinding out all these side quests. And there's so much content. The world is so fun to explore. And despite saying last time that I was going to not play Gwent to cut some time, I'm kind of getting into Gwent a little bit. Yeah.
It's good.
It is fun. Yeah. And which I forget if we mentioned, but it's like the in-game card game. And you can like buy new cards from vendors. You can win them off of certain characters. So, and you can win money too, even though it's a small amount of money, but you can bet money in it. So, yeah, I was kind of getting into it. And there's a couple story things, like optional story things where you can play it during the main story as well. So I was like, well, I want to have a deck that's good enough that I don't just always lose during these main story elements when I have a chance to play. Although they typically do make it a little bit easier. So been doing that a little bit. Man, I forgot how just brutally violent this game is. Like every time you finish a fight, particularly with human enemies, it just goes to like a slow-mo cutscene of Geralt just like cutting them in half, like their head goes flying off. Yeah, the story, the voice acting, all so good. And I've been really, really enjoying, I'm doing kind of teching into different character skills than I did last time, because there's plenty of room for replayability just because there's three main skill trees that you can go down and you can dabble in all of them as well. But the three skill trees can really affect your playstyle, you know, whether it's one that really buffs your physical attacks, one that buffs the potions and oils that you can put on your sword or potions that you can drink, and then one that buffs the signs that you cast, which are like you can shoot fire, you can knock people over, you can create a barrier around yourself. Then there's crafting of gear too, which certain like armor sets, like there's light armor, medium armor, heavy armor, and different sets and set bonuses you can get later in the game that complement different play styles. I don't know if I leaned into that at all the first time I played the game, because I'm looking at all this and I'm like, holy cow, like you can really go down a niche and get super strong. But it's been a lot of fun so far. I've been focusing on the potions and oils because I didn't use them a lot before, but it can just make like potions that make your crit chance go up like by 15%. If I dump a lot into this skill tree, instead of lasting 2 minutes, it'll last like 10 minutes or something like that. Yeah, and there's lore around all of it too, which I really love, just because the potions and blade oils are in all of the books. You know, it's things that Geralt canonically uses, and I just still half of my time playing this game is going into the bestiary and reading all the descriptions for all the different monsters that you fight, because there's just so much fun info in there, and I love that kind of world building. So yeah, I'm gonna be in it for a while, but I'm still loving it.
Yeah. Well, I gotta be careful listening to you because I might have the itch to go back in as well.
yeah then we'll both be talking about Witcher 3 for like 3 weeks or something at least. Yeah.
Long time.
Yeah.
It's another game I've never beaten.
Yeah,
I feel like I've never even gotten halfway through. It's so big.
If the Fallout 4 trend is anything like it, maybe I'll beat it and then you'll be like, okay, you know what? It's time to go back for it.
I'm a little worried because I know in my Humble Bundle, one of the biggest games that I haven't pulled that I'm going to end up playing is the new Metro game. And that's a pretty big one, isn't it?
Oh, Metro Exodus, right?
Yes.
Yes, it is pretty big. I mean, I think that is less daunting than Witcher 3.
Yeah.
But it does go a little bit more open world than the previous games. Like, there's side quests and there's things you can explore. Yeah, but that's a really good one. I mean, it'll take you some time, but I'm excited for you to play that. It's fun.
Yeah. So who knows when that'll come, but it's hopefully not too much longer.
Nice.
All right, but we're going to talk about Pitfall today, Wes.
Oh, yeah.
But before we do, we have some other Atari 2600 games that we need to talk about. And for a weird reason, there's something weird going on with a third-party company. They're taking the Atari 2600 hardware into their own hands.
Yes. Yeah. And making a hardware add-on for the 2600 called the 2600 Supercharger, or the StarPath Supercharger. With a name like that, you know, big hopes that it's going to do some great stuff for the 2600.
It's going to supercharge it.
Right? It sounds like it should. But we'll have to see as we talk about some of the games. But a little bit of background on StarPath, the company that made this. They were actually founded in 1981, originally called the Arcadia Corporation. But then shortly thereafter, Emerson released their Emerson Arcadia console, and they had to change their name. So now they're StarPath, which is a pretty sweet name. But the supercharger device that they made was this, like, basically really tall cartridge that you could slot into the 2600. And when you plugged it into the 2600, it upgraded the 128 bytes of RAM on the 2600 to have 6 more kilobytes. So that's like taking 128 and adding 6,000 more bytes to it, basically. So it's going to give this a lot more storage, and games that are compatible with the supercharger are going to have just a lot more room to mess around with more detailed graphics, more complexity to the game, or at least that's the idea behind this. The catch is, though, that because this supercharger takes the cartridge slot, and the way that it was designed is that it just has a cable coming out of it that you plug into a cassette player. And instead of being cartridge games, supercharger games are cassettes. So, like, I don't know. It's weird. There's no, like, backwards compatibility or, like, anything like that. It's just you have to play these games through cassettes. And we've heard some speculation that the reasons for this are mainly because cassettes were so cheap to produce. The StarPath supercharger games only cost $15 compared to, I think, 2600 cartridge games were like $30 to $40, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, a pretty big cut there to cost savings and the promise of it doing a lot more because it's got a lot more storage. It all seems like it could be pretty good. They had a really funny commercial, too, where this dad with fantastic acting is basically saying, "My son wants computer games now that he's got all these console games, but that's too expensive. Buy a supercharger instead." And just upgrade your 2600. So yeah, that's basically what it did. It retailed for about $70 at the time, I think.
It's $70. You can get a ZX81 for $100, I think. It's still kind of expensive.
Yeah, yeah, it's not cheap for sure. And I mean, I don't know what the release for this game was. I know, like, when you bought it for $70, it came with one game, I think. But... Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's going to be a lot of games that have with it too. So,
right. Yeah. Unfortunately, if you're a company and you're not named StarPath, it's going to be hard for you to figure out what's going on here.
Yes.
It's a completely different, like, hardware device that you even plug into the system. But yeah, so definitely an interesting one. The StarPath Supercharger, it's looked backed on from, like, Atari 2600 fans as being a really good thing because some of the best games ever made on the Atari 2600 apparently come out through the supercharger. So it's going to give us a little bit of new life, but then that's not always the case. The games are only better if the developers use all the new power.
Right.
And we're going to find out if that was the case or not. So let's take a short break and then head over into the timeline and talk about some Atari 2600 games. Hello and welcome back. We are going to hop into today with some Atari 2600 games, as we mentioned. Let's talk about the new Supercharger games. There were two that released in September of 1982, which is where we are at in the timeline. The first one is called Phaser Patrol. I believe this was a pack-in game with the Supercharger. So everybody got this one. And it's a Star Raiders or Star Trek turret gunning type game. It actually runs a little bit better than Star Raiders, I think, which is a game I think originally released for the Atari 8-bit. I can't remember if it's on the 2600 or not, if there were support. But it looks pretty good. I mean, it's a turret gunning game, and unfortunately it's in space. So, like, space games aren't the best for showing off new graphics because it's right. mostly just a black background. So, but, you know, it ran pretty well and I guess looked okay. So, probably not the one I would have packed in. You know, it's not the Donkey Kong that was in the ColecoVision, but wasn't bad either.
Yeah, you got to wonder why they didn't go with this next one, which is very of the time. It's called Communist Mutants from Space. Also by Starpath, as we mentioned, I think. I mean, we'll see as we go along, but almost all the games for the Supercharger are by Starpath. Mm-hmm. And this one is a Galaxian-type game, but there were some cool power-ups, including a slow-mo effect. Might be the first kind of like slow-mo effect we've seen, especially in like a power-up form in a game, but not too much else going on other than that.
All right, and that's it for Starpath for now. The best games are going to come out a little bit later. We decided not to cover them because, honestly, these last couple months of the year are so packed that we've got so many good ones to cover, including this next one. It was a game that came out in September of 82 for the 2600 as well, but not part of Starpath, just a normal game for the Atari 2600, but it's a big one. It's Pitfall by Activision. More specifically by David Crane, which is interesting because how I know that, Wes, I didn't even look it up. I just watched a couple commercials and they say it in every commercial. Pitfall by David Crane by Activision.
There you go.
Which is kind of Activision's thing, right?
Yeah.
The whole reason they separated from Atari in the first place is to get credit for making the games, and they did that in the commercials for sure. But yeah, this one, it's one of the best-selling Atari 2600 games of all time. I'll go into the actual numbers a little bit later in the relevance section, but it's a pretty big deal. So we felt like we had to cover this one. And I was glad to do so. I mean, it's kind of like a mix of Donkey Kong meets the game Adventure from Atari, or maybe even like the game Superman that we've done on the 2600. As you know, with both of those games, they're kind of played on a bunch of different screens that are all connected. So you're on one screen, you can walk around from left to right, and if you get to the edge of a screen, it'll kind of refresh and you're on like a new room. If you move from to the edge of that room, you enter a different room, and it's just kind of never ending. In this game, there's a lot of rooms. There's 255 scenes is what they're called. Yeah, that's a lot. And they're all unique. They're all like made of the same components, so it's not like 255 completely unique rooms, but I say unique in that, you know, like one will have a spider, one will have a scorpion, one will have a spider and a scorpion, or not a spider, a snake and a scorpion. So it's like not that many elements, but all arranged slightly differently to make different rooms, if that makes sense. And essentially what your goal is, you have a timer that's counting down at all times on the screen. It's a 20-minute timer, so the gameplay lasts 20 minutes or until you lose your 3 lives. And your main goal is to find all the treasures. There's 32 treasures hidden in these 255 scenes. And if you find all 32, then you win. Otherwise, you just kind of get as many points possible. And it is very difficult to collect the 32 treasures in 20 minutes. It takes just a while to move from one side of the screen to the other, you know, a couple seconds, and that adds up over 255 scenes. Not to mention the fact that there's some dead ends, some like backtracking you have to do at times. And part of what allows you to even do all 32 treasures in the time allotted at all is that there's some like underground sections. So there's kind of like a main level like in the middle of the screen, which is the surface of the ground, which is where you're playing mostly, but then under that there's kind of like a cave section which you can see at all times and only can occasionally go down and up from it through ladders. But in the underground sections there's apparently some like, I don't know, I forget the wording they use, but it kind of like skips you ahead several screens. I think they're called shortcuts that you can use in the underground section. So if you don't know where those are, it can be hard to accomplish the goal in 20 minutes. So David Crane actually says, I think in the manual, he recommends making a map of the game similar to a text adventure to find where all the treasures are. And then once you know exactly what the map is, you can hopefully get them all in 20 minutes. But it's supposed to be very difficult. The actual gameplay is not difficult, though. That's the kind of like two sides of this game. I mean, if you want to like complete the game, very hard. If you want to just play the game for fun, not that hard. Like you have a move left and right button, a jump button to jump over the obstacles. I'll explain them in a sec. And a down button you have to use to go up and down the ladders, but also jump down from vines. So on some of the screens, there'll be like a pit in the middle of the scene and a vine swinging left to right. And you have to jump up, grab the vine when it's close to you, and to exit the vine, something I didn't realize until I actually played the game, you don't just jump again, which is what I would expect.
Right.
You actually have to hit the down button to jump off, which is a little different, but it works. Like as soon as you do it a couple times, you're like, okay, I understand. And it's not a big deal. But some of the other things you're jumping over, there's some rolling barrels that will roll from the right to the left side always. This is a bit of an interesting mechanic because since you're always rolling right to left and you can do the 255 scenes, it's kind of like a wraparound world, if that makes sense. So scene 255 goes into scene 1, but you can also go backwards. You can go from scene 1 to scene 255. Which means you can enter from the right side of the screen, meaning the barrels are always in front of you and you never have to jump over them if you go backwards in the game. Hopefully that makes sense, but kind of an interesting mechanic. I went backwards. I found it a lot easier playing through the game that way because I didn't have to worry about the barrels. But you're jumping over them if you play the game forwards anyway. If the barrels hit you, interestingly enough, you don't lose a life. You just kind of like stagger for a little bit, so you just lose a little bit of time, and it's very light. It's like a second, you know, so the barrels really aren't a big deal. You also have some pits. There's two different types of pits. There's like these square pits, which just have you fall down into the cave area below the ground layer. They don't really hurt you or anything. But then there's also these more circular pits, I guess. They can either be like black pits or blue for water. And I believe they both kill you. I'm almost positive that some of the black pit killed me when I was there, but maybe you can jump down the black pit into the cave underground section. I'm not sure, but you want to avoid them. And there are some scenes where the pits can open up quickly and close quickly, kind of on like a timing loop. So quite a few of my deaths were entering a new room and seeing like no real enemies or obstacles and just running forward, and then a pit would open up underneath my guy and I'd die. So you have to either, you know, write down where those rooms are to avoid them or stop when you get there, or just go a little slower than I was going to avoid that. But for those circular pits, you either have to walk over them when they're closed or use a vine to swing over them or use the alligators. Because if it's a water pit, there can be alligators in the water. The alligator's mouth will either be open or closed. There's three of them, and all of them will be open at the same time or closed at the same time. You can only jump on them when they're closed. However, there is a safe spot to stand on them if their mouths do open, which is right on their eyeballs. So they're not too bad. They're fairly easy enemies. I think the only other enemies in the game, there's a fire that you have to jump over, a scorpion and a snake. The scorpion moves. I don't think the other two move. But yeah, that's pretty much the game. It's a bunch of jumping, running around this giant maze of a world that's 255 rooms, looking for treasure, and trying to do it all in under 20 minutes. So with that being said, let me get into my ratings. This one, both of my games I reviewed today, Wes, were hard to review for different reasons. I feel like this one is so iconic and so beloved. It's hard for me to like say, nah, it's not that good. Like, everybody says it's good, you know, and I think it is really good, especially looking at it from the perspective of just an Atari 2600 game, which is hard for us because we review so many arcade games. And it's not as good as an arcade game at all.
Right.
It's just not at that level. But as an Atari 2600 game, it's really good. So, I don't know. I see what you think of my ratings, Wes.
Yeah.
For the gameplay, I ended up going 3.25 out of 10. At the end of the day, it's just a timing-based game of jumping at the right time. I do love the vine swinging, and I love the fact that there's this big world to navigate, but I'm not going to map out 255 rooms. That's not fun to me. And because of the shortcut system, it was very hard to understand where I was in that world sometimes, because I would like go two screens over, see nothing, get to a dead end, go back, go underground, go one scene over, and the top is someplace I've never been to before. I'm like, what? Where, you know, where am I? I remember going backwards at the start. I must have done going backwards for 20 screens. I didn't see any treasure at all. And I was like, am I doing this right? Eventually, I did find a treasure really far in, but it felt like a lot of me just hitting, like, especially going backwards where you don't have to jump over the barrels. You enter a screen, I hit left and start walking. I time my jump to jump over like one or two little minor things. And then next screen, I basically held down the movement button at all times. And which, if you have to do that, then it's not that interesting. Might as well just be a timing-based game where you just hit the jump button, you know, time it right, and not have any movement at all, if that makes sense. So, I don't know. I was on the fence about it. I think it is good. There's, like, a lot of ambition here with what it can do. And I think the actual platforming is quite good. I think the jumping is a little bit better feeling than Donkey Kong, which was an arcade game.
Okay.
So that's great. So the actual jumping mechanic was good. The vine swinging felt really good as well. I think both of them had a little bit of a easier difficulty curve. Like, I was able to pick it up a little quicker than some of the arcade games we've played. So that helped it a lot. You know, it's just like an easy one to hop into, and you don't have to worry about the treasures or do anything. You can just have fun jumping around with your guy. And I think that the game's good at that too. So it's overall decent. I gave it 3.25. I think it's probably one of the best games for the 2600. It's just hard for me to give it more than that when we've seen arcade games do so much more. So gave it 3.25 for the gameplay. For the graphics, I also gave that a 3.25. Honestly, I love the graphics for this. I think on the Atari 2600, I don't think there's a game we've played that has looked this good. It's just because it uses a lot of color in it and not a lot of black, I think. I mean, the cave part at the bottom has a black screen background, but the top half of the screen, or two-thirds of the screen, is like yellow for the ground, a light green background, and then dark green for leaves of trees and brown tree stumps. So it just looks really colorful, very much like you're in the jungle. I love some of the effects, like the vine swinging looks good. The pits opening and closing the ground look good. I think all the character sprites look great. Your guy looks really good and has some nice animations. He's a multicolored sprite. You've got a single color sprite for the scorpion and a single color sprite for the snake. I think the fire is multicolored and has a little animation of it flickering. So that's nice. But I just think overall it's one of the best looking Atari 2600 games. Again, I don't think it approaches anything in the arcade world in 1982. But I would say it looks maybe even better than some Atari 8-bit games that we've seen. So I thought it was very good. 3.25 out of 10 for the graphics. The sound is going to be what kills the rating for this game, unfortunately. Man, there are just not many sounds in this. I mean, there's like vine swinging. When you do that, there's like a little, like, Tarzan kind of noise. Like, it's a musical noise, but it's supposed to represent the, you know, kind of screaming right. That Tarzan does. Love that. I love there's a musical tune when you die, which is kind of like iconic to Pitfall, which is really good. I think there's some noise when you jump, but like there are some screens where I didn't have to jump. And it was just the whole screen, probably 10 seconds of just walking left or right and just nothing played. It was just dead silent. I'm like, I can't, that's so bad. Like there's just not enough noise in this. There's no background music, I think, is what really kind of does it. So if there's not a whole lot going on the screen that, you know, warrants a lot of different inputs from you, there's just no sound and it's boring. So I don't know. I gave it a 2 out of 10 for sound because there were like multiple 15 second stretches where there was just nothing that played when I played. So couldn't go higher than that. Now for relevance, this is a big one, and I think it's big not just because it sells well and people know it, but listen to this, Wes. According to Wikipedia, so, you know, take that as you will, the best-selling Atari 2600 games of all time, the top three are Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and Donkey Kong, then you've got Pitfall and Frogger, and the next two are Asteroids and Defender. So of the top seven games, six of them are ports of arcade games, and only Pitfall is a unique game just for the 2600. That's of the top seven best-selling Atari 2600 games, which I think is incredibly important and just remarkable. Yeah. I think to me, that kind of puts Pitfall as, if you think, what is an Atari 2600 game that I know, it's Pitfall, because you don't think Pac-Man. Pac-Man's an arcade game. At least I don't. You know, even though Pac-Man sold the best, I think Pitfall, because Pitfall is a unique game for the Atari 2600, whereas all the other ones are ports. So in some ways, I think this is the most popular and most, like, true to the Atari 2600 game that there is, you know, in a lot of ways. So I think this is very, very relevant. I think, at least to me, it's the game I think of when I think Atari 2600. So I'm really glad to have gotten here.
Yeah.
And been able to play this one. It's a long time coming. And for relevance, for that reason, I went pretty high. I mean, unfortunately, for all you older listeners who love Pitfall, I guarantee you, young people don't know what Pitfall is. Unfortunately, as much as we want it to still be relevant in 2025, it's not. I talk to, I've got music students. I teach music. And I will often ask, there's a certain song that I have them play sometimes that has to do with Frogger, and people don't know what Frogger is. And I feel like if you don't know what Frogger is, you're not going to know what Pitfall is.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, it doesn't really hold up in 2025. I still think it's very, very, very relevant. So I gave it a 9 out of 10. Incredibly important one. Estimated sales are around 4 million, which, wow, coming out so close to the video game crash of 1983 is crazy. But I think it just was that good compared to the other games on the system at the time. All right, moving on to my overall rating. I gave it a 2.75. It's a low rating mainly because of the sound. I do think the graphics and the gameplay are great, and I would put those two aspects up there with the best games that I've ever done on the Atari 2600. So I do think it's really good, but unfortunately, it was just so bad sound-wise, it brought the whole score down. But I think from my personal list, I got to put Pitfall up pretty high. But I don't think it's going to make Game of the Year. I mean, there's a lot of arcade games that are just way better than it at the same time. So everything in perspective, right?
Yeah.
But what do you think, Wes? Did you know Pitfall? I think you did, right?
Yeah, at least vaguely. Like, just knowing it was a popular and important game in video game history, but didn't really know much about it other than the vine swinging.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fun to hear about it. And it definitely is just very unique. You know, like you said, it's original, which is great. Mm-hmm. Activision's still doing good stuff. And this is a popular game that people probably remembered and liked on a console because you couldn't play much else like that on a console.
Yeah.
So very cool. Yeah. Yeah. Even if the sounds aren't too great.
Yeah.
All right, but why don't we move on now to some computer games? We're going to start things off by talking about the Sinclair Users Magazine for September. It's a new magazine for us, mostly ZX81 games, and there wasn't really too much of note before now, but there was one that we wanted to talk about in this issue, and that is a game called HMS Hermes by Trevor Wallen, and it was a simple shooting game for the ZX81. but it was made by a sailor actively in the Navy on the HMS Hermes, which is pretty cool. Whilst being part of the Falklands War that we talked about before of 1982.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of time considering he was like in an active war zone.
You gotta sail places, you know.
All right, let's move on to some other computer games. The first one we got here is called The Biles Toad by Datamost. This was a top-down fighting game that was really cool graphically for the Apple II that came out sometime in 1982. It had vibes of, what was it, Warrior? Is that the game?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that came out for on vector graphics systems a while ago. It was kind of like that. I thought it looked amazing, but man, it just ran at like 2 frames a second. It was horrible. So we couldn't really review it.
And then we have one called Tubeway by Datamost. This also came out for the Apple II. It was a pretty impressive port of Tempest, the arcade game, to the Apple II. It had many different stages and layouts, just like the original arcade game. So pretty cool.
All right, and then the next one is called Warrior of Ross, Volume 2 Cave, or Kiev, I don't know, by Screenplay. Came out September 13th, 1982, for the Apple II and the TRS-80. This is actually the sequel to the game Dungeon, which I believe we did review. This one, even though it's Volume 2 and came out a little bit later, didn't really change that much. It had slightly better graphics, not too great though. And this one did have an inventory system, was like the main gameplay thing it added, but wasn't really different enough for us to want to take another look at it. There are more volumes though, so.
Let's see.
Yeah.
And see what other words they spell interestingly, like dungeon and cave. All right, but next there was a computer game that we definitely wanted to take a look at, and that is called Necromancer by Synapse Software for the Atari 8-bit computer. Came out sometime in 1982. This game is really interesting visually, gameplay-wise. There's just a lot going on, so I really wanted to take a look at it. It's by a guy named Bill Williams, who we've seen before for a game he did called Salmon Run. And in this game, you play as the druid Illuminar trying to defeat the Necromancer Tetragorn. So some great fantasy names in there. I don't know if there's much more build up in the manual than that. You're just, you know, you got to beat the necromancer.
Mm-hmm.
But this game is crazy. There's some really interesting mechanics, and you'll kind of have to stick with me here as I explain what the heck is going on, because there's also 3 completely different stages to the game. So to start out on the first stage, you're in this like top-down view sort of where your character, the druid, is standing in the center of the screen, and you have a wisp that you control with the keyboard or a joystick or whatever that you control independently of your druid. When you move it around screen, it kills the enemies on screen. The enemies that show up are ogres with big like clubs on their shoulder that just run into you. They just kind of walk aimlessly all over the screen, but they will damage your character if you get hit. And the main goal of this stage of the game is to plant and protect trees as they grow. Instead of having like, you know, one hit and you die, this is a game that goes off a strength meter that slowly decays as the game goes on. And then also you get a chunk out of it if one of the ogres hits you. And the game proceeds to the next stage once you go down to 0, I believe, or after a certain amount of time. But if you go to 0 too early, the game might end. I'm not sure, because in the other stages, when your strength goes to 0, you end. But the first stage, it's a little confusing. But the trees, you have a set number of seeds in your inventory. I think you start with 8. Using the wisp, you plant them wherever the wisp is, which kind of acts like a cursor. The trees grow in multiple stages slowly over time, and the ogres basically shrink or destroy it and have it go down a couple stages whenever they hit it. So if it's grown more, it won't totally get destroyed if an ogre hits it, but if you just planted it, the ogre will totally destroy it. There's certain enemies that rarely spawn or spawn at certain points during the first stage that if you kill them, you get more seeds. And then there are also spiders that spawn, and they can run into you and hurt you as well, but then they can also plant eggs on the trees, which basically act as time bombs. And there's like sort of a beeping and they flash, and then if you don't destroy the egg with your wisp before the time goes up, that tree will be dead. And it'll just be a stump in its place. And the reason you're doing all of this is that In the next stage, the amount of trees that you have is very important. So you kind of just want to plant as many trees as you can and keep as many as you can alive. And you get points for killing all the enemies along the way too. After the stage ends, you go on to a side view instead of the top-down view where you're sort of in like these catacombs that I think are called the vaults in the game. And you still control the Wisp, but now you can also control the Druid and move around as well. What you have to do is there's like these two levels and four little like alcoves or like pitfalls, kind of, where there's spider eggs incubating in them, four on each of these levels. You have to take your Wisp, go possess one of the trees that you grew, and then control the tree to make it walk on top of the floor where the spider egg is below, and then plant it so that the roots destroy the floor and the tree falls onto the egg, crushing it. The logic here is impeccable. I love it. You keep doing this until you destroy all the spider eggs, but if you run out of trees, you can also just pick up these little like question marks that spawn on the ground to release the ladder to go down to the next level. After you go through five different levels of the second stage, you go to the third level. Some of the other things happening on the second stage, though, the eggs, if you don't blow them up fast enough, they hatch and turn into spiders that run around and try to kill you, and I think shoot you through the walls, which is a little crazy, but you can still destroy them with the Wisp. And then also there's hands that come from the top of the screen called Doom Fists, I think, and they can either grab you and drain your strength, or if your tree is under it, they'll grab the tree and permanently take that tree away from you. You can also pick up any trees that have successfully destroyed a spider egg, because you only have the amount of trees you can use is however many survived from the first stage. Okay, so all that's going on. You're destroying the spider eggs, you got these trees, and then you descend five different levels, and then you get to the final stage where you're showing off with the necromancer in a graveyard. This also has a carryover effect where the amount of spiders that spawn depends on how many eggs were left in the previous stage. But the necromancer shows up, teleports all over the place, and shoots fire, but you can destroy him with the Wisp. And he only spawns from graves that have tombstones on top of them. So you have to run over the graves, stomp all over the graves, I guess, and get rid of the tombstones to make it so he has less locations where he can spawn, and keep hitting him to kill him. And that's it. There's a lot going on, man. This game is just totally nuts, but it's a lot of fun. So let me get into my ratings now for this game. For graphics, I gave this a 3 out of 10. Most of this game is a black background, but honestly, the stuff on screen makes up for it a ton. The Druid and the Wisp both look pretty good. The Druid's just kind of a simple, I think, green figure in a robe, but has some okay detail. And the Wisp is just kind of like this color-changing, flashing circle. Nothing too great there. I really do like the ogres on the first stage, though. And I really love the trees because they're going through multiple sprites as they grow. And then on the second stage, you have these bricks for the vault that look pretty good. There's a little bit less black background on the screen. There's more going on. And the silly yellow hands that come down from the ceiling are really fun, too. The spiders frantically moving across the screen, and the eggs look kind of just okay, but again, the trees are the star of this stage too, visually. They lose their green leaves when you possess them, but they get eyes and a mouth, so it's like a treant, you know, or like the, I forget what they're called in Lord of the Rings, but the tree people just moving around. Mm-hmm. And once you plant it, you can actually see the roots growing through the bricks before the floor breaks, which is a really nice effect. And then the third stage is just back to a majority black background. Honestly, stuff is moving too fast to really tell what's going on. There's like 500 spiders on screen, but it looked pretty good. The graves looked decent. Necromancer looks okay, but his fire attack looks really good. For some reason, it's brown, but the fire does have like multiple sprites of it kind of burning and then fizzling out, which look awesome. Moving on to sounds, I was really surprised by these. I gave this a 2.75 out of 10. It's a lot of just beeping sounds, but honestly, I didn't mind them. They work pretty well. The first and last stage is sort of just a lot of different noises at once, but you learn pretty quickly which noise is the spider, which noise is an egg about to hatch, which noise is the seed pods. So I felt like all that worked pretty well. And the second stage has like this really fun, sort of different toned beep song going on. along with all the other beefs that are going on. And it's a short loop, but it really gave a nice vibe to that stage. That was definitely my favorite stage to play. So pretty good overall for Atari 8-bit. Moving on to gameplay, I gave this a 3 out of 10. The game is brutally hard, to be honest, and it's really weird to control, but it was still a lot of fun, which I think says something, and I feel like it serves some points just for the originality of the gameplay. There's so much weird stuff going on. The first stage is just frantic mayhem, and it feels really difficult to plant the trees where you want them because the wisp moves so fast, but still it somehow works, and it's really fun when you see like this forest growing around you of all the trees that you've planted. Protecting the trees as they grow is a lot of fun too. And the second stage is really interesting when you're switching between moving the wizard and the trees around. I like that there's sort of an obstacle course where you have to learn the timing of the hands coming from the ceiling and dodge them to be able to get through that stage. And then once you get to the third level, it seems like everything's moving way too fast. I didn't get there personally because the second stage was pretty hard when there's 5 different levels of it. But it's still a really neat concept, and I'd like the idea of the first stage carrying over the number of trees that you planted into the second stage. For relevance, I gave this a 6 out of 10. It seems like a fairly well-remembered Atari 8-bit game, but not super popular. I don't think the gameplay is going to be that influential on anything else, but it's super original. And overall, that left me with a 3 out of 10 for Necromancer. Super solid game for the Atari 8-bit computers. It's unique. It does everything pretty well, including sounds, which I wasn't expecting. The theme is just so weird and awesome. I love it. And it's just fun to grow and then control magic trees. Yeah.
Nice. And it's so fast paced. It's crazy, like, what the frame rate is on this.
Yeah. And with the amount of stuff on screen, too. I should have tried it with a joystick, because I'll be honest, playing it with a keyboard was a little rough, but still, very cool game.
All right. Well, let's get out of computer games, Wes. Let's move into some arcade games. Well, kind of. Over this next one. This game released in September 1982, where we are, but it's half a video game, and it's half a pinball machine. It's called Caveman by Gottlieb. It's the first ever video game pinball hybrid.
Okay.
And this is weird. I mean, you know, with Pitfall, I was feeling the pressure of the Atari 2600 fans to give high scores. This one was hard to rate for a different reason, because it's half an actual pinball table. How much do I include that in my ratings? But yeah, if you can imagine, it's a pinball table, like a real-life physical pinball table with moving pieces, right? And the bumpers and paddles and everything. Physical pieces. But if you can hit the ball in a certain place on the table, it kind of like goes into this little cubby and gets stored there, so it's, you're no longer like actively playing the pinball machine part. And there's a screen right above the pinball table part, where a video game gets played, and you have a joystick that's part of the pinball table, and you switch to that and play this video game part. I think, you know, for pinball mechanics, I'm sure there are some better named, but I'm just going to say they're pinball mechanics, so I'm not going to talk about that too much. But for the gameplay mechanics, when you play the game, kind of plays like Pac-Man. You've got a maze similar to Pac-Man. There's no like power pill or like little dots to collect, though. And this one, you've got, I think it's either 5 or 6 enemies on screen. You play as a caveman in this, the game is called Caveman, like the pinball table is called that. And it's got caveman theming, but you play as a caveman sprite in the game. And when you start out the game, all the enemies are like a green colored dinosaur. And those green ones, you can just eat, essentially, like it was a Pac-Man game. In this game, it's themed like you're a caveman with one of those giant sticks that looks like a hammer, right? Think like Flintstones. And you can hammer them. So you can basically destroy all the enemies. The trick or unique part about this game is that when you destroy an enemy or eat them, they kind of stop moving for a little while, but then will eventually come back to life as a T-Rex, which is a red enemy. And the T-Rex will seek you and try to kill you. So the question is, can you kill all of the enemies yourself before the T-Rexes spawn and kill you? If you can do that, you go to like a new stage where five new enemies spawn, everything's a little faster, everything's worth a little bit more points, and you try to continue to do that. If you feel like, oh man, I'm gonna die, there's at least one place, it was hard to find video of this game in action, so I'm not sure if, like, there's kind of like these four exits on the middles of each edge of the screen, and I've only ever seen people go back into the pinball part of the game by exiting on the bottom entrance or exit. So I don't know if that's the only one you can use or if you could use any of them, not sure. But definitely, if you use that bottom exit, you can continue playing the pinball part and kind of like escape the maze and say, this is too hard, I'm getting out of here. And you leave the maze and you're back to playing pinball, racking up the score, and you can continue to even go back into the video game again. Or you continue playing the video game part. If you get eaten, then the actual pinball table ball is lost. So you do not want to do that. You would definitely want to rack up as many points as you can in the video game part and then get out before you lose a life in the video game part. There is only one other special mechanic, which is that if you play the pinball table machine in a certain way, get certain things to light up, hit certain bumpers or whatever, it'll activate like a special ball that will spawn in the video game part. If you collect that with your character, you actually get another pinball ball in real life. So basically an extra life, which is cool. So that's basically what the game is. It's half a pinball table, like a real one, and half kind of a Pac-Man game where it's like, imagine Pac-Man, but like some of the ghosts are always invulnerable. And then once you eat them, they become real ghosts and you have to eat them all before the real ghosts get you. And if you do, the whole thing resets. That's pretty much what it is. It is a unique game. It's not just Pac-Man, which I was kind of expecting. I don't know why. I was expecting the game to not be good, for being honest. But I think if this was released as an arcade game, I'd be like, it's not good. But yeah, I would say it released in 82. You know, like, I don't think it was that bad. So yeah, this one was really hard to rate. So let me get into my ratings. I mean, what do you think I should do for the gameplay? It's like, I think the playing of the pinball table is fun, and then playing a video game in the middle of your pinball table session sounds fun to me, and the game isn't that bad. So it's like,
yeah,
how much do these things stack up on each other? Ended up going 4 out of 10 for the gameplay, because I thought as an overall package it was just decent, you know, like I would enjoy playing the pinball table just to play the pinball table, and then you've got a game here. And I thought the game was pretty interesting and unique and novel in and of itself. So I was like, yeah, this is good. And what's funny is, like, if I was playing just the pinball table, I might be like, well, this is getting boring after a while. And if I was playing just the game, I'd be like, this is getting boring after, but I can do both. So
right,
that's the whole point. So yeah, I thought it was pretty good. Pinball table has 4 paddles. So it's not like a super simple pinball table layout. I believe Gottlieb made a bunch of pinball tables and were very good at it. So like, it's a solid pinball table just in of itself. So I went fairly high, 4 out of 10. I mean, graphics, again, really hard. Do I count the art on the pinball table?
Oof.
To me, it's almost like saying, you know, should I count the artwork on like the marquee of an arcade cabinet?
Right.
But it's a little different, obviously. I will say I like the art on this quite a lot. I mean, if I was judging, like, I don't know much about pinball tables. I haven't looked at 1,000 pinball tables. Maybe this artwork sucks, you know, if you know pinball tables, but to me, as someone who doesn't know anything, I like the artwork. It's got a bit of a neon vibe to it. So I don't know if it lights up exactly in black light like I think it does, but it's got those colors. It's like very vibrant greens, oranges, and yellows, and even some blues. And just, you know, total caveman theming throughout, a bunch of dinosaurs, a bunch of like caveman, cavewoman, Flintstones kind of style theming. But also with that neon thing happening, I think it could look really cool in a dark room. At least that's what I can gather from the colors. It feels like it's neon colors. So I think it's great. I mean, like, if I had the money, would I get this just for the pinball table artwork? I kind of think I would. Like, I like it a lot. I would probably give that part of it like in 7 or 8 out of 10, you know. And then the actual game, you know, a lot of the game is just a black screen, but unlike even just Pac-Man, which has just like a single line essentially to separate the spaces in the maze, there's like pictures in this maze that kind of fill little quadrants of the maze to kind of give a little barrier. And the pictures are multicolored pictures of like mammoths and cave people and dinosaurs, and it's cool looking. I think the caveman sprite looks great. The enemy dinosaurs look pretty good. Like, they're multicolored, they've got animation. And if you can complete a wave, there's going to be a color palette change between every wave. So that's nice. Also something that they added, which is good. So I think that gameplay looks pretty good. I probably would, if I was judging just the game, maybe like a 3 out of 10. So where does that leave me? I guess it leaves me with like a 4.5 out of 10 for the graphics.
Okay.
If we nice. Average those, I don't know. Or maybe it should be higher. I don't know. I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 10. I think it's quite good. Like, to me, it's the artwork on it is nicer than just a normal arcade game. And the fact that the arcade game itself is pretty solid, I think, means that it's not too low in any one direction. Like, it's all pretty decent. So, yeah. For sound effects, I went 3.5 out of 10. I mean, you've got pinball machine sound effects because you're playing an actual pinball machine. There's some weird like space noises and stuff sometimes, but you also have some digitized speech in here, which is cool. Obviously, a bunch of little music tunes. When you actually play the video game part, there's a bit of a drone background in the style of Space Invaders, which is a lot better than nothing. So I thought it was pretty decent. Nothing like too crazy, you know, no long musical sections or anything like that, but pretty good. So 3.5 out of 10 there. For relevance, the first ever pinball video game hybrid, I went 8 out of 10. You might think, well, why shouldn't it be higher? Because it's the first of its kind, but there's honestly not many, from what I can tell, not many of these games made in this kind of hybrid style, so this trend didn't catch on. There are a couple others, but not many. But still, it was the first of its kind. Give it 8 out of 10, and overall, that left me with a 4 out of 10 for Caveman. It's kind of weird. Like, it almost feels like it's a cheating, like it doesn't deserve to be in the same category as a normal video game.
Right.
Like, there's so many other things going on with it, but we felt like we should cover it. It is a video game, you know, in there, and there's not too many of these, so we might as well cover them on the podcast, even though we don't usually cover pinball machines. So, but yeah, I mean, having a really nice pinball machine attached to your video game will help its scores. I've learned that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and it's hard. You can't score them like that separately because it's part of the game. Like, it's all together. So, yeah, I think it makes sense the way you scored it just because it's got both going on. Why not rate them together? It's very cool.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Like, flow of the gameplay seems interesting because it's like suddenly you're switching to the video game portion of it, but it's cool. I dig it.
Yeah, there is like a little bit of a delay, so you don't have to be like super quick on the joystick, okay. Which is nice. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, overall, it was cool. I thought the layout of the table was cool. Again, if I had bought just the pinball table, I'd be like, this is a cool table, you know? And then there's a whole video game in there.
Right. Yeah.
So it was just good. Yeah.
Definitely another dream collector's item right there. Real weird and unique.
Definitely. I'll put it right up there with Blue Shark. I still need that one.
Oh, yeah. All right, but let's move on. We got a couple more arcade games to mention. The next one we have here is Jolly Jogger by Taito. Came out in September, and it was a take on a sort of like Pac-Man / Amidar kind of game, but not a very good take, unfortunately. But this last arcade game we have for today is a great one, and it's my second review for the day. It is Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator by Sega. And this is a very cool game. Yeah. It released, we believe, towards the end of 82, because I think the US version wasn't until 83, but the Japanese version might have been a bit earlier. But so right around here. It had a couple different cabinet versions, but the sit-down cabinet was awesome. It had like a chair modeled after the command chairs in the original Star Trek series. The controls for it, like the joysticks and the buttons, were actually on the arms of the chair for that version, which is pretty sweet. You feel like you're commanding the Starship Enterprise. But no matter which one you play, it did have synthesized speech, and I don't think it was actually Leonard Nimoy, but, you know, a Spock-like voice saying, "Welcome aboard, Captain," which is fantastic. This is, you know, it's Sega. They're a big enough company that they, of course, had to fully license this. So it actually has the Paramount trademark right at the beginning of the game, which is interesting. It also came in a kit version, and I thought it was hilarious that Sega advertised that it could turn any arcade cabinet into Star Trek because it came with its own monitor, and this is a color vector graphics game. But they specifically called out like Asteroids and Scramble. So they're like, hey, get rid of those games from other companies that suck and turn it into Star Trek, which I think is pretty funny. But apparently, I mean, this doesn't affect too much for my review. When the arcade cabinet initially released, it had a lot of electronics issues and often didn't work. But the hardware itself is still pretty sweet. And, you know, I got to play a version that was working well enough. Getting into the gameplay of Star Trek, it is a sort of like first-person shooter space game. Like, it makes me think of a turret gunning game in space because that's usually what we see, but you're actually flying the ship as well. So it's more like first-person Bosconian, kind of. It's really interesting. You're moving in space and flying and shooting at the same time. It's not, you know, the things in front of you look 3D because it's vector graphics, but you're on a single plane. Like, you can move in circles, you can look all around, but you can't go up and down in space. But what you're doing basically is going through each sector and trying to destroy all the Klingons in each sector. It's not like old school computer Trek games where you pick which sector. Each sector is basically just a level that has a certain number of Klingons on it, and then you go to the next level. The screen itself is really interesting because the whole screen isn't dedicated to, you know, the first person view of the Enterprise. It's actually broken up into three sections. The top left section is just a visual readout of your current shields, your current amount of photon torpedoes, and how much warp fuel you have left. The top right side of the screen is a top-down radar view of the sector that you're currently in, which shows your ship, any space stations, and any enemy ships. It even shows the projectiles of the enemy ships, so I found myself dodging using that when I wasn't facing the enemies, which was really interesting. And then the bottom section of the screen, which is like the whole bottom half of the screen, basically, is your first-person perspective of the Enterprise. The graphics, as I said, are color vector graphics, which is pretty sweet, so everything scales really smoothly as you get closer to it. Each sector has a set number of Klingons to kill in it, and after destroying them all, you move to the next sector. There can also be space stations or bases, like I mentioned, where if you run into them, you dock with them, and once per level, that station will restore your shields, give you an additional photon missile, and I think give you some warp fuel as well. You have lasers as your main firing method, and then also limited number of photon torpedoes. And then the warp button, instead of teleporting you randomly, it basically just acts like a boost button. So it lets you move really fast if you're like surrounded by enemies, get out of there, and you consume the warp fuel as you're using it. So that's the basic gameplay. You're flying around, shooting enemy Klingon ships. You actually have to, or can choose to defend the bases as well, because the Klingons don't just attack you, they attack the star bases, and you get a bonus if you defend them. Let me move into my ratings now, because there's a lot to talk about here. This is a really cool game, and I kind of wasn't expecting how much I was going to like it when I, you know, first started watching videos on it. But the graphics, despite being color vector graphics in space, which could be, you know, kind of boring, just black background, I really liked these. I gave it a 4 out of 10 for graphics. I don't know if it's the space theme or what, but I just love it. There's, of course, a lot of black on screen, but they do have pink stars all over the place, and they actually do fly by you as you fly through space, so it gives that effect of speed, even though you're in space, which is great. The radar on the top left is super helpful. Like I said, it shows enemy projectiles. It shows a little shield around the tiny version of the Enterprise when your shields are up, and then it disappears when they're down. So there's, you know, multiple visual indicators of when your shields are still up, which is great. In the main screen, I love the look of the Klingon warbirds. I mean, if you've seen the original series, it's, you know, just a wireframe red and yellow outline sort of version of it, but it's perfect. The way that, like, because it's vector graphics and they're rendering this thing to look 3D, like, every angle that you approach it, that it looks at you, looks different. And it's so well detailed and looks really, really good. And like I said, the scaling is also really good too. So as you get closer, you just get more and more detail of these ships. The lasers you fire are just simple lines. They're actually like, you know, 3D sort of lasers that look really good. There's this sort of like hex grid that shows up on the whole screen when your shields get hit to make it look like your shields are lighting up. The explosions are like, you know, the ships flying into different chunks like we love from vector games. And I'm just really impressed with how smooth everything was in this. It makes me think of what I've seen of the game Wing Commander, which I think is wireframe on a computer and not vector graphics. And we're not there quite yet, but it's just making me real excited for this type of space game. And there's a little animation between the sectors after you beat all the Klingons where the radar Enterprise gets larger, takes up more of the screen, like sort of warps over to the side. Then once you get to a new stage, it gets smaller again and slots back into the radar that I really enjoyed. And something I forgot while I was reviewing it or writing this up is that whenever you hover over, like the center of your screen is over a Klingon warbird, there's actually a 3D spinning reticle over the enemy ship to say, like, they're in your target, shoot them now. Which I don't think we've really seen any game do before. So I enjoyed that a lot. Moving on to sounds now. Yet again, I like this a lot. I might be a little biased here because I like Star Trek, but the game starts off with like a bit of the classic theme. So that's already fantastic. Then you have Robot Spock saying, "Welcome aboard, Captain." I think Scotty says something too. It's perfect. Unfortunately, the synthesized voice isn't in too much of the game, but every time you beat a sector, it does have Spot saying, entering sector, whichever, 1.2, 1.3, or things like that. The music doesn't continue through the game either, but honestly, that didn't bother me too much because there are lots of other great sounds going on in this game. There's laser noises, explosions, docking sounds, sounds for your shield getting hit, sounds for the ship getting hit without shields, because you can also take damage once your shields are down. And all of it's just very spacey and works really well for the game. So I ended up giving it a 3.75 out of 10. I feel like that's really rare for a game that doesn't have music during the gameplay, but everything just felt so full, it didn't bother me at all.
Welcome aboard, Captain. Entering sector 1.2. Entering sector 1.2. entering sector 3.1. Congratulations, high score.
And moving on to gameplay, I gave this a 4.25 out of 10. I had a ton of fun with this game. It's still pretty simple. Like, the gameplay loop is simple, so that's why it didn't get a little bit higher from me. But it's taking that turret gunning space game that we've seen to the next level, because you can now fly the ship. Feels like Bosconian, except in first person. I like how your reticle lights up when you shoot. I like how the radar was super helpful and actually really useful. I really like that the bases, the Klingons can attack them and destroy them, so there's another target other than just you. And I like that you get a bonus when you keep it alive. I didn't use the torpedoes too much, but having multiple types of weapons and also resource management with the shields, torpedoes, and warp fuel was really cool. And just when I was starting to think that the gameplay was a little too simple, I got three stages in and came across a totally different type of stage, where there was only one enemy on screen, but it was a drone that was flying around planting mines all around me. And you actually have to destroy this drone and avoid all the mines to make it through that stage. I just loved that there was that variety in there. I don't know how frequent those different types of stages are, but it was just really cool, played really smoothly, and it was a lot of fun. Moving on to relevance, I gave this a 7 out of 10. It's a pretty awesome Star Trek game, and Star Trek is kind of always relevant, especially at this time. It makes me think of some of the like kind of cockpit Star Wars arcade games that we're going to see later down the line. So I'm excited for that. And it just feels like the next evolution of the turret gunning space arcade game. So I'm really excited to see people try to do things like this. And overall, that left me with a 4 out of 10 for Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator. It's a fantastic game. The gameplay is fun and smooth. There's great sounds. Color vector graphics are really interesting. Maybe could use a bit more music and speech, but other than that, I thought it was really good. Gameplay could be maybe a little bit more complex, a little bit more variety, but sitting down and playing for a little bit, I just had a ton of fun with it.
All right, nice, man. I'm glad you liked it so much. Definitely one that I can see myself if I sat down in the sit-down cabinet version. I could be like, oh, I'm in a new world now, you know?
Yeah.
So that's really cool. But yeah, that's it for arcade games for today. That's it for reviews. We do have a couple quick honorable mentions. We have to talk about the VC4000 one more time this year. It's a second gen console that came out a number of years ago. I don't think we reviewed any of the games in the first set, and we didn't decide to review any games in the second set either. As a reminder, we don't have month dates for these games, so I kind of just broke them up into two sets to kind of talk about them all together. And this is the second set of two what we're doing for the year, so this is the last time we're talking about the VC4000. Interestingly enough, all of these games actually didn't release on the VC4000. They all released on cloned VC4000 consoles by some other company. So the first one here is called Cowboy, and it was for the Rotron release of their version of the VC4000 only. This is a simple two-person shooting game that unfortunately was done better in Western Gun in 1975.
And then we also have Monster Munchers for the Rotron version. It is a two-player Pac-Man variant where one player is chasing the other player. Ends up more like a cat-and-mouse type game than Pac-Man, and there's no pellets to pick up, so meh, just kind of okay.
Kind of along the same lines, we've got Munch and Crunch by the Volt Mace version of the console. This was a more authentic Pac-Man type game, but was just okay.
And then we have Leapfrog for the Volt Mace version. It's a pretty normal Frogger clone. Nothing bad, but nothing too great either.
And then the last one for today is called Come Frutas, I'm going to say. It was by the company TRQ, released for their version of the VC4000. This is another Pac-Man clone. But in this one, there's no pellets again, but fruit randomly spawns somewhere in the map, and you have to go for that while the ghosts chase you. So
makes sense.
Very slightly different take.
It literally translates to like eat fruit or something like that. So,
probably. Yeah. All right, but that's going to do it for us today. I hope you guys enjoyed today's extra long episode. We did Pitfall on the Atari 2600. Also checked out the Supercharger on the Atari 2600. Lots of good stuff coming out of that console for now. We'll see if how much longer that lasts. Not too much longer. We also did Necromancer by Synapse Software. Crazy fast-paced one. I did Caveman, the first ever pinball video game hybrid. And finally, Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator. Did I miss a word in there, Wes?
No, you got it.
Okay. It's a really good one, though. Vector graphics, super cool. But yeah, another big one down, Wes.
Yeah, absolutely. Make sure to keep tuning in if you guys are enjoying our trip through the history of video games. We've got a website where we've got some great information on things that we've covered before. We also have an account on X where we post about any announcements we have about our episodes that are coming out. We have a YouTube channel where we're putting up videos of our older episodes and also some videos of me and Ben going head-to-head in video games. And if you have any other questions, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.